A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel grew up in Ireland, where the cop on the beat doesn't carry a gun. Then he moved to Israel, where the idea of an unarmed officer is almost incomprehensible. He says even when he left Ireland a decade ago, there were armed response units for exceptional needs. So his question is this: how many countries still maintain unarmed police forces? And in an increasingly volatile world, when even those unarmed forces often need armed backup, how viable and how fair to frontline officers is it to keep sending them out without weapons? That's a question that sits right at the intersection of history, operational reality, and ethics. And I think the deeper thing Daniel's getting at is whether unarmed policing is a noble relic or a viable modern model.
It's a harder question than it looks, because the first thing you run into is that the label unarmed police force doesn't actually mean what most people think it means. It's not a binary. You're not either armed or unarmed in some absolute sense. Every country that gets described as having an unarmed police force, every single one, maintains armed response units. The question is about the default posture of the officer on patrol. Does the routine constable, the beat cop, carry a firearm as standard equipment? In most of the world, yes. In a shrinking handful of countries, no.
So, before we get to viability and fairness, let's answer the straightforward part of Daniel's question. How many countries are we actually talking about?
It's a short list. Ireland, with the Garda Síochána. The United Kingdom, except for Northern Ireland, where the police service of Northern Ireland is routinely armed. Norway, Iceland, New Zealand. And then a few smaller jurisdictions, some Pacific Island nations, a handful of British overseas territories. You're looking at probably fewer than a dozen full national jurisdictions where the default patrol officer is unarmed, and even that number is slipping. New Zealand, for example, has been having a very public debate about routine arming for years now, and they've been inching toward it incrementally, trialing armed patrol units, expanding firearms access for officers in certain situations.
So the club is small and getting smaller.
And the distinction that actually matters is routinely unarmed versus never armed. Because if you look at the UK, the Metropolitan Police, London's force, has about 3,400 authorized firearms officers out of roughly 34,000 officers total. That's about 10%. But those armed officers are distributed across armed response vehicles, the Specialist Firearms Command, and counterterrorism units. They're not walking the beat with a sidearm, but they're on standby, and they can be on scene in minutes.
Which is exactly the dynamic Daniel noticed. The armed backup unit that exists alongside the unarmed officer. And that raises a question that's going to run through this whole episode. If you need armed officers on standby to handle the situations your unarmed officers can't, what exactly is the unarmed model doing for you?
To answer that, you have to understand where it came from. And this is where Ireland's story is genuinely fascinating, because the Garda Síochána's unarmed status wasn't an accident or a budget decision. It was a foundational identity statement.
Walk me through it.
The Garda was founded in 1922, right after the Irish War of Independence and the partition of Ireland. Before that, policing in Ireland was done by the Royal Irish Constabulary, the RIC, which was an armed paramilitary force stationed in fortified barracks deeply integrated with the British administration. During the War of Independence, the RIC was a target. They were seen as an occupying force, and they were. When the Irish Free State was established, the new government made a deliberate decision. The new police force would be the opposite of the RIC in every way. Unarmed, unbarracked in the military sense, recruited from the community. Answerable to civilian authority. The very name, Garda Síochána, means guardians of the peace, not enforcers of the state. Guardians of the peace.
So the lack of a gun wasn't a tactical choice. It was a political one. The gun was the symbol of what they were breaking from.
And this wasn't unique to Ireland. It was modeled on the British tradition. The Metropolitan Police in London was founded in 1829 under Robert Peel, and Peel's principles explicitly prioritized public cooperation over force. The famous line is that the police are the public and the public are the police. The idea was that the officer's authority came from the consent of the community, not from the threat of violence. And part of that consent was demonstrated by the officer being visibly unarmed, carrying only a truncheon, later a baton. The uniform itself was designed to look civilian adjacent, not military. No firearms, no sabers on routine patrol.
Peel's principles. The bobby on the beat with nothing but a whistle and a wooden stick.
And it worked, in its context. Victorian London had plenty of violence, but the baseline of civilian gun ownership was low, and the social contract, however imperfect, held well enough that the unarmed model became a point of national pride. It said something about British society that the police didn't need guns. Ireland inherited that model and then doubled down on it, because for Ireland, the armed police officer was specifically the face of colonial occupation. The unarmed Garda was a declaration of sovereignty. We don't need to point guns at our own people.
Which is a powerful idea, but it also means the model is tied to a very specific set of conditions. Low civilian gun ownership, high public trust, a shared understanding that the police are us, not them. What happens when those conditions start to fray?
That's the viability question. And the uncomfortable answer is that the unarmed model depends on a social context that's eroding in a lot of places. You need two things to make it work. One, a low baseline of civilian firearms. If every domestic dispute has a non-zero chance of involving a gun, sending an unarmed officer into it stops being principled and starts being reckless. Two, a high baseline of public trust. The officer's authority has to be maintained through presence and legitimacy rather than through the implied threat of lethal force. If the public stops believing in that legitimacy, the unarmed officer is just a person in a uniform with no real power.
And those two things tend to travel together. Places with low gun ownership tend to be places with high social trust, and vice versa. So it's hard to disentangle whether the unarmed model works because it's a good model, or because it only exists in places that were already safe enough not to need armed police.
That's the data problem. There's no clean comparative study that can tell you, unarmed policing reduces police shootings by X percent, or unarmed policing increases officer fatalities by Y percent, because the countries that do it are so different from the countries that don't. Ireland, Norway, Iceland, New Zealand. These are small, wealthy, high-trust societies with low violent crime rates by global standards. You can't compare them to the United States or Brazil or South Africa and draw conclusions about the model. The variables are too confounded. Is it the policing model that produces the outcomes, or is it the underlying society?
So the "does it work?" question is almost unanswerable in the abstract. But the fairness question, that one you can sink your teeth into. Is it fair to send an officer into a situation where they might face an armed suspect with nothing but a baton and pepper spray?
Let me put this in terms I understand from medicine. If you send a nurse into a ward where there's a known risk of violent patients, and you don't give them any protective equipment or training, you're asking them to absorb a risk that the system has decided not to manage. That's not principled. That's cost shifting. You're taking a systemic risk and downloading it onto the individual.
And that's the charge against unarmed policing, isn't it? That it's a noble ideal paid for by the frontline officer who has to face down a knife or a gun with nothing but de-escalation training and a hope that backup arrives in time.
And the evidence suggests this isn't just theoretical. Ireland has one of the lowest rates of police-involved shootings in the developed world, which is the upside. The unarmed model does change the statistical profile of encounters. Officers who don't have a gun can't shoot someone. That sounds tautological, but it matters. In the United States, police shoot and kill roughly 1,000 people a year. In Ireland, the number is typically 0 or 1. That's not an accident. When the default tool isn't lethal, the default outcome isn't lethal.
But the trade-off?
The trade-off is that officers get hurt and killed. Ireland has a documented pattern of Garda officers being injured or killed in confrontations where an armed response might have changed the outcome. The most famous case is Detective Garda Jerry McCabe, who was shot dead in 1996 during an armed robbery by members of the Provisional IRA. He was on escort duty, unarmed, and the attackers had automatic weapons. That case became a national trauma precisely because it crystallized the vulnerability of the unarmed officer.
And that was 1996. The threat landscape has shifted since then. Daniel mentioned he left Ireland a decade ago, and even then armed response units existed. What's changed?
The big shift happened around 2008. Ireland went through a period of intense organized crime violence, gangland feuds in Dublin and Limerick, drug-related shootings, a level of armed criminality that the unarmed Garda patrol officer was never designed to handle. In response, the Garda Armed Support Unit was formally established in 2008. These are specialist officers with firearms training, deployed in patrol cars, available to respond to armed incidents. And that's the model now. The default officer on the beat in Dublin or Cork or Galway is unarmed, but if a call comes in involving a firearm, that officer's job is to contain, observe, and wait for the ASU. They aren't expected to engage.
Which brings us back to Daniel's point about the armed backup paradox. The unarmed officer's first move in an armed confrontation is to disengage and call for support. That means the armed unit arrives after the threat has already materialized. The response is inherently reactive.
The response time gap is where the risk lives. In an urban area, an armed support unit might be on scene in 5 to 10 minutes. In rural Ireland, it could be 30 minutes or more. During that window, the unarmed officer is managing an armed situation with nothing but communication skills and the hope that the situation doesn't escalate. That's the fairness problem in a nutshell. The system's response to an armed threat is to send an unarmed person to wait for an armed person.
You got this strange two-tier reality. The public-facing image is the friendly unarmed Garda, the guardian of the peace, the symbol of a society that doesn't need guns. But behind that image is a parallel armed structure that's been growing steadily for 15 years, handling the situations the friendly unarmed Garda can't touch.
Ireland isn't alone in this. The UK has been moving in the same direction, faster. Since the 2015 Paris attacks and the 2017 Manchester Arena bombing, the Metropolitan Police has been deploying armed officers on routine patrol in London and other major cities. Not all officers. The default is still unarmed. But the visible presence of armed police in train stations, airports, and public events has become normalized. The Specialist Firearms Command, which is the Met's counter-terrorism firearms unit, has expanded significantly. Armed response vehicles are now a standard part of policing in every UK force.
The unarmed label is increasingly a spectrum, not a binary. You've got fully armed forces like most of the world. You've got routinely unarmed forces with growing armed backup structures like Ireland and the UK. And then you've got a few places. Iceland, maybe some of the Pacific Islands, where the armed capacity is minimal.
Iceland is an interesting case. The Icelandic police are routinely unarmed, and they have a tiny armed response capability, a specialized unit called the Viking Squad that handles the most serious incidents. But Iceland also has one of the lowest violent crime rates in the world, extremely low gun ownership despite high gun possession per capita, and a population of under 400,000. It's basically the ideal conditions for unarmed policing. And even there, the Viking Squad exists.
The Viking Squad. That's the most Icelandic thing I've ever heard.
It is. But it makes the point. Even in the safest, most homogeneous, highest trust society you can imagine, the police maintain some armed capacity. The question is never armed or unarmed. It's what's the default posture and what's the escalation path?
The escalation path is where the fairness question bites hardest. Because the officer on the default posture, the unarmed one, is the one who encounters the situation first. They're the tripwire. They're the person who has to make the judgment call about whether to engage or disengage, and they're making that call without the tool that might save their life if they get it wrong.
There's a counter-argument that I want to take seriously because it's not nothing. The counter-argument says that the unarmed model changes the nature of the encounter in a way that actually makes officers safer, not more vulnerable. The logic goes like this. When an officer is armed, every encounter carries the implicit threat of lethal force, and that can escalate situations that might otherwise de-escalate. A suspect who knows the officer has a gun might reach for their own weapon preemptively. An officer who knows they have lethal capacity might default to it under stress rather than working through de-escalation. The unarmed model forces a different kind of policing, one built on communication, patience, and the understanding that you can't end this encounter with a bullet, so you'd better find another way.
There's some evidence for that, right? The low police shooting numbers in Ireland and the UK aren't just about gun availability. They're about training culture.
They are. British and Irish police officers receive extensive training in de-escalation and conflict resolution precisely because they don't have a firearm as a fallback. The unarmed status shapes the entire training curriculum. In the United States, police training is heavily weighted toward firearms proficiency and use of force protocols. In the UK, it's weighted toward communication, negotiation, and tactical disengagement. The tool you carry determines the skills you develop.
But that argument has a limit, and the limit is the armed suspect who doesn't care about your de-escalation training, the terrorist, the organized crime hitman, the person in the middle of a psychotic episode with a knife. There are situations where communication fails, and in those situations, the unarmed officer is relying entirely on luck and backup.
That's why every unarmed force has built an armed backup structure. The question is whether that structure is adequate, and whether the division of labor is fair. If you're a Garda officer in a rural station, and you get a call about a domestic disturbance where the suspect is known to have a shotgun, and the nearest armed support unit is 40 minutes away, what do? You can't just not respond. So you go, unarmed, and you hope you can talk your way through it. And most of the time, you can. Most of the time, the presence of a uniform and a calm voice is enough. But most of the time is cold comfort when you're the one walking up to the door.
That's the thing about fairness. It's not a statistical question. It's a question about who bears the risk. And in the unarmed model, the risk is asymmetrically borne by the frontline officer. The system gets to claim the moral high ground of unarmed policing, and the officer gets to absorb the consequences.
There's a parallel here to what we've talked about before, the blurry line between military and police missions. Armed response units occupy this strange middle ground. They're not soldiers, but they're trained in military-style tactics. They're not routine police, but they're deployed in policing situations. And their existence creates a structural tension within the force. The unarmed officers are doing community policing, building relationships, maintaining the social contract. The armed officers are doing something closer to counterterrorism or tactical intervention, and those two cultures don't always mesh well.
The Garda has had tensions around this. The armed support unit is seen by some within the force as a necessary evolution, and by others as a betrayal of the Garda's founding ethos. The unarmed tradition is deeply tied to Irish national identity. Changing it isn't just a policy decision, it's a cultural one.
That's why the shift has been so incremental. No Irish government wants to be the one that arms the Garda. It'd be seen as an admission that something fundamental about Irish society has changed, that the peace the Garda were supposed to guard is no longer guardable without guns. That's a painful thing for a country to confront.
But the shift is happening anyway. It's just happening through the back door, expanding the ASU, increasing the number of armed detectives, normalizing the presence of armed officers at airports and government buildings. The default patrol officer is still unarmed, but the armed capacity is growing, and the situations where it's deployed are expanding. It's death by a thousand qualifications.
That might be the most honest way to describe where we are. The unarmed model isn't dead, but it's on life support, and the life support is the armed backup unit. The question Daniel asked, how viable is this model? The answer is that it's viable only to the extent that the armed backup is robust. And the more robust the armed backup becomes, the less meaningful the unarmed label is.
Let me try to synthesize what we've actually learned here. The how many question has a deceptively simple answer. Fewer than a dozen countries maintain routinely unarmed police forces, but the real insight is that every single one of them has built armed backup structures. So the question isn't unarmed or armed. It's what's the default posture and what's the escalation path.
The viability question can't be answered in the abstract. Unarmed policing works where gun ownership is low and public trust is high. It fails where those conditions don't hold. And those conditions are eroding in a lot of places. Not uniformly, not catastrophically, but steadily. The UK's expansion of armed patrols since 2016 is a direct response to terrorism. Ireland's establishment of the ASU in 2008 was a direct response to organized crime. The model adapts because it has to.
But the fairness question, that's the one that should drive policy, because the burden of the unarmed model falls on individual officers. The system owes them either better de-escalation training, better protective equipment, or a more honest conversation about when armed backup is acceptable and how fast it can arrive. You can't just declare that your police are unarmed and then leave them to figure out what to do when the unthinkable happens.
The Steelman counterargument here is that we're overstating the risk. The number of Garda officers killed in the line of duty is extremely low. Ireland is, by any measure, a safe country to be a police officer. The unarmed model has worked for a century. The armed backup structure is adequate for the threats that actually materialize. Changing the model in response to edge cases, the terrorist attack that happens once a decade, the gangland shooting that makes headlines but doesn't represent the daily reality of policing, would be an overreaction that sacrifices the community trust that makes Irish policing effective in the first place.
There's truth in that. Most police work in any country isn't armed confrontation. It's traffic stops and noise complaints and domestic disputes and welfare checks. The unarmed officer is perfectly equipped for 95% of what they actually do. The question is whether the 5% justifies changing the model for everyone, all the time, or whether the armed backup approach, accepting some risk at the front line in exchange for preserving the unarmed default, is the right trade-off.
I don't think there's a clean answer to that. It depends on what you value. If you value minimizing police-involved shootings above all else, the unarmed model is demonstrably superior. If you value minimizing officer fatalities above all else, the armed model has a strong case. Most people, I suspect, want something in between, a model that protects officers without turning every encounter into a potential shooting. And that's basically what the armed backup structure is trying to achieve.
For Daniel, who's seen both sides, the unarmed Garda of his childhood and the routinely armed police of Israel, the answer is that the unarmed model is real, it's shrinking, and it's more complicated than either its defenders or its critics usually admit. It's not a noble relic, but it's not a viable universal model either. It's a context-dependent design choice that works under specific conditions and requires constant adaptation as those conditions change.
The thing I keep coming back to is that the model forces a question that armed forces can sometimes avoid asking. What's the police officer's job, actually? Is it to enforce the law through the threat of force, or is it to maintain public order through presence and legitimacy? The unarmed model answers that question one way. The armed model answers it another. And the armed backup approach tries to split the difference, maintain the legitimacy of the unarmed officer while acknowledging that force is sometimes necessary.
Whether that split is sustainable is the open question. As organized crime becomes more transnational and terrorism remains a persistent threat, can any country maintain an unarmed police force? Or is the armed backup unit the thin end of the wedge? The thing that starts as an exception and gradually becomes the norm?
If the unarmed model does fade away, what's lost in the transition? It's not just a policy. It's a statement about what kind of society you want to live in. The Garda officer without a gun is saying something about Ireland, that the relationship between the state and the citizen doesn't have to be mediated by the threat of violence. That's worth preserving if it can be preserved. The question is whether it can.
If this episode sparked a question about policing, security, or the social contract, and I suspect it might have, send it in. The weirdest prompts make the best episodes. You can reach us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us on track. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread.
My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host.
My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.